This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, January 26, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. After the attack on the Capitol that ended in five deaths and a rattled legislative branch, there is rising fear that the White House and Democratic majorities in both houses will seek new authorities to crack down on extremism in ways that would look a lot like a Patriot Act, explicitly for domestic law enforcement. Cato's Patrick Eddington and Julian Sanchez comment. On Friday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announced the Biden administration would take some efforts to combat what they call domestic violent extremism. The Director of National Intelligence will oversee a comprehensive threat assessment. The National Security Council will build capability to counter extremism and disrupt extremist networks. And federal departments will coordinate on what they call evolving threats. This is all in response to the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. So to you, Pat, what does this mean? Because it sounds to me like one of two things. One, we're not really going to do all that much, but here's the language we're going to use to make it sound like we are, or we're taking this very seriously and hold on to your rights.
The latter would probably be the correct response, unfortunately. If we go back to the 1950s and the Cold War era, you had a unit within the National Security Council staff that was dedicated to, quote, domestic security. And I think what I also found disturbing about her statements this afternoon was the involvement of the Director of National Intelligence in looking at, quote, this domestic threat. DNI was created, and the intelligence community as a whole exists to deal with foreign threats. So I think there's a lot to be concerned about here going forward. You know, the FBI has been dealing with what I will refer to essentially as white supremacist or white nationalist type movements for a very, very, very long time. Have they put the same level of effort into that as they have looking at people of color? I think the answer is no. They haven't even come close. The difficulty with all of this is that when we start talking about groups, that's when we begin to slide into essentially the possibility of mass surveillance, mass suppression of rights, et cetera, et cetera. I was really very angry, frankly, when I saw Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, tweet yesterday something to the effect about basically trying to find a way to shut down the speech, effectively shut down the speech of some of these folks. And, I guess she needs a refresher on Brandenburg v. Ohio, because the Supreme Court, you know, ruled on that problem over 50 years ago. There's a lot of speech that goes on that I don't like, that probably everybody listening to this podcast doesn't necessarily like. But, you know, we have a First Amendment for a reason. And I think at the end of the day, we have to realize that what happened on January the 6th and everything that led up to it is fundamentally a political and a social problem. And it's going to take, in my view, a non-securitized approach to that problem to really address it. And I do think in his Inauguration Day speech, the president was trying to do that, but this announcement today really kind of runs counter to that, in my judgment.
Although I'd add, you know, to balance that, at least perhaps, Rashida Tlaib and several of her colleagues did send a letter urging against an expansion of the national security state or surveillance authorities in response to that attack. And I think that's maybe the critical thing. I think we've seen calls not just for task forces or prioritizing domestic terror groups or white nationalist groups, but also calls to start shifting the foreign-aimed international terrorism post 9/11 approach to domestic adversaries, sort of bringing the war on terror home even to a greater extent. And so it was somewhat heartening to see some opposition to that. I think we saw an outpouring of think pieces in the aftermath of the riots at the Capitol on the 6th, saying, well, what we really need now is a new domestic terror charge, as though somehow we were unable to prosecute people who invade government property and destroy property and threaten people without a specific piece of legislation calling it domestic terrorism as opposed to merely, you know, trespassing, vandalism, assault, and other, you know, other criminal activities. And, you know, I think there's a bit of a pattern that we saw in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and is maybe rearing its head again now, which is institutional failures and bureaucratic failures are tacitly excused by the demand for new authorities. So they say, well, we need new surveillance authorities. We need a new organization. And, you know, either explicitly or implicitly, what they're saying is we have failed because you did not give us enough power and not because, you know, our institutions are in various ways dysfunctional and we had the authority we needed and we simply failed. The demand for new authority is a way of excusing the failure to appropriately use the authorities you already had. And so I think you should listen to it, through that filter, view it through that lens when you hear people saying things like, this shows we need new domestic terror legislation.
Government failed, therefore give us more government. Yeah, that's that pretty well, I think, sums up where we're going right now.
This is from the letter. While we are not necessarily opposed to reforms to address the law enforcement and intelligence community's inability or unwillingness to seriously confront domestic white nationalist violence, we firmly believe that the national security and surveillance powers of the U.S. government are already too broad, undefined, and unaccountable to the people. To further degrade those rights and liberties in reaction to this attack would undermine our democracy at a time when we must join together to defend it with all of our collective might. While many may find comfort in increased national security power, in the wake of this attack, we must emphasize that we have been here before and we have seen where that road leads. Our history is littered with examples of initiatives sold as being necessary to fight extremism that quickly devolve into tools used for the mass violation of the human and civil rights of the American people. And then they detail the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Federal Bureau of Investigation's COINTELPRO program, the USA Patriot Act, and the FBI's Assessment Authority and Operation Iron Fist. So in looking at this, if this is something the White House is taking seriously, and this is signed by multiple members of Congress, Earl Blumenauer, Ro Khanna, Barbara Lee, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Ayanna Pressley, among others, Republicans were gung-ho for the Patriot Act. And I think that that occurred sort of very quickly in the wake of 9/11. This was, if not a day after, just days after 9/11. How do we slow this kind of thing down? I mean, this seems like an attempt to slow it down and say, hey, let's think about this and not turn these authorities, which are many of which are unnecessary already, against Americans explicitly.
I think the biggest problem that I worry about is that, you know, Washington remains very tribal. And so, you know, folks can put their names on letters. And, you know, I helped to write a lot of those for my boss back in the day when I worked on the Hill. But Mr. Biden is trying to govern with razor thin margins, basically in both chambers, in a country that is clearly very polarized and divided. And I think Democrats are going to rally around Biden in terms of what he wants to do. The Progressive Caucus, with folks like AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and now Cori Bush from my home state of Missouri, may be there in the breach to try to prevent some of this stuff. But I really do fear that when push comes to shove, if the administration were to actually promulgate some kind of legislation that we would find objectionable, that there may end up being a little bit more support for it than any of us, you know, would really be comfortable with. So this comes down to, you know, major figures in the Senate on the Democratic side standing up. It can't just be Ron Wyden. You know, we need more folks than that. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
Let me be very pointed here. What has Ron Wyden said in the wake of the attack on the Capitol?
I have not actually gone to his website or looked very closely at his Twitter feed thus far. What I do know is that he remains very seized of a concern about the ability of federal law enforcement to buy data from companies like Twitter and the others that give law enforcement the ability to essentially engage in tracking people without actually getting a warrant. And I think a lot of other folks are kind of waking up essentially to that reality. But I haven't seen, to be fair to him, I have not reviewed his website, press releases, et cetera, to see if he has actually come out and said flat out, we cannot have a so-called domestic terrorism law.
Julian, what infrastructure exists already that President Biden might want to try to strengthen or expand to deal with what they call violent domestic extremists?
Well, you know, frankly, the existing law enforcement infrastructure, I just don't think there's an obvious reason that this needs to be treated differently from, you know, any other group that may commit, violent acts that we deal with through, right, existing investigatory powers, agencies like the FBI when necessary, or state agencies. But we have seen proposals to, that frankly, I think, and perhaps this is excessively cynical, may not do a lot of good, but have the benefit of acting as a kind of placebo. There's a bill already floated by Representative Schneier and Senator Durbin that is billed as domestic terror legislation, but doesn't really create new authorities. It codifies an existing sort of information sharing task force between the agencies. And as Pat said, I think, to the extent you're looping in intelligence to this, that's not necessarily a great sign. But fundamentally, it's about information sharing and about prioritizing the most serious threats and requiring a report to Congress on the state of domestic terror threats. And that's aimed, I think, significantly at the sense that to date, federal law enforcement, certainly state and federal law enforcement, have perhaps not been prioritizing the most serious actual threats. They've been very interested in, looking at, for example, what they call black identity extremists and groups like BLM, and maybe treating that as a disproportionate threat relative to domestic white nationalist groups, which may be more likely to raise hackles because of their proximity to more mainstream political groups. This bill, I don't know that it's necessary, but to the extent that it allows them to say, well, we've done something, may just, insofar as it doesn't do these more harmful things, again, be preferable as a placebo. You get the sense that I think members of Congress sort of recognize that the underlying problem here is not, frankly, a need for new legislation, but that there's a desire to say, look what we're doing. We have done something in response to this attack. We're not just sitting on our hands here. And so in some sense, you may need something to give them to say, look what we did. And to the extent that they have something to do that is at least not particularly harmful, that may, to some extent, sort of quench the appetite for more harmful measures.
All right. Pat, the Capitol attackers on January 6th, many of them did law enforcement an enormous favor. They live streamed themselves. They took many photos.
Yeah.
One state representative from West Virginia, upon bursting into the Capitol, yelled his name and then said, "Is in the Capitol." what should law enforcement do with that information? This case seems like a bunch of people who do not understand that they all committed violent felonies.
So what we have here are what I like to refer to as the stupid criminals, right? These are the people who went and as you just indicated, videoed themselves committing multiple federal felonies on the grounds of the Capitol, including, of course, major acts of vandalism, property destruction, theft of, in the case of Speaker Pelosi, apparently her computer by one particular individual. In any event, they broadcast literally to the world what they were doing. And because they did that, it makes it incredibly easy for law enforcement to grab this stuff. And of course, in the case of some of these folks, they've been using automatic license plate reader data down the line, right? I mean, just anything that essentially winds up being publicly available, they've made that part of the Bureau's job, you know, very, very easy in that respect. I'll tell you, just bluntly, we got very lucky on January the 6th. And that is because we had essentially a bunch of yahoos, a mob, with really limited organization show up. What's getting attention now from some members of the press, and this was very prominently featured by NPR late yesterday, is the fact that of the, you know, 70 plus people that have been arrested so far, and it may be closer to 80 or 90 by now, but about one in five have prior military service. And that compares to about a 7% overall representation in the U.S. population. And so what I fear, what I'm very concerned about, is that now we will see essentially an effort on the part of law enforcement to go to the Defense Manpower Data Center at the Pentagon and say, we want the names of everybody who's now prior service. We especially want the names of people with knowledge of explosives. We want the names of all former special operations folks. And that they will begin to essentially engage in or try to engage in a pattern matching operation where they begin to kind of put these folks on a list and maybe run it against additional data that they have out there. That's what I worry about. I'm not downplaying the fact that that we had the incident, not for a single minute. It was clearly an act of insurrection. But I think it would be a real mistake to just automatically assume that anybody with prior military service is necessarily, you know, a threat to their neighbors or to the existing constitutional order. But I fear that at least in some quarters, and very likely on the left, political left, we're going to see some flames be fanned here, at least rhetorically, and maybe more to kind of go down that road. But there's no question that the FBI, working with their state and local law enforcement partners, have an enormous amount of data that's available to them to basically go after the folks that have been surfaced. I will tell you that it's not these people that worry me. The people that would worry me would be more like Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols. And even though those guys, you know, made some noise, published some newspaper articles, all the rest of that, their overall operational security in building that bomb that destroyed the building in Oklahoma City in 1995 was pretty damn good. And it's people that are really dedicated revolutionaries, people that understand how to maintain operational security. And that's not the three percenters. That's not the Oath Keepers. These clowns show up at state capitals. These guys that tried to put together this plot to capture and potentially kill Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. They showed up at state capitol over the summer, which is one reason why law enforcement was able to figure out who they were. It's the ones that understand how to maintain operational security, that know how to maintain a genuine cell. That's what worries me. And I think that's really where law enforcement ought to be spending their time and their energy, frankly.
No, I'd say one thing that's clear from the aftermath of the riot in the capitol is that you have a mixture of a lot of people who were essentially engaged in trespassing and perhaps not anything much more serious than that. Some people who engaged in vandalism, a few people who ended up committing violence against law enforcement officers, and then a relatively small number of people who had actual designs on doing serious harm, potentially attacking members of Congress or Mike Pence. And, you know, on the one hand, some of these people are in effect acting as sort of useful idiots, giving cover to the ones with more malign intentions. But it's, I think, important to, distinguish between people who, you know, indeed maybe committed a crime of trespassing and should face some penalty for it, and the ones who did actual damage. I think it is probably not in the interest of people who believe in, a robust right of protest to conflate those things in a way that says, everyone present at a protest, even if they may be committing some offense that amounts to civil disobedience, is effectively guilty of the worst action, even rhetorically, we're discussing this in affidavits, right, is guilty of the worst thing someone present did. One of the things that makes it difficult is that It's sometimes hard to assess the guilt if you have a group of people going in and some of them are doing serious harm. I mean, killing a police officer in one case, and others are in some sense helping by being part of that crowd, even if they don't commit the action themselves. But when you look at their individual conduct, it's hard to find something more serious than effectively trespassing to charge. You know, in the long term, I think it's in our interest to keep those things distinct. I think a lot of the kinds of proposals we're hearing for treating some of these things as you know, complicity with domestic terrorism are very easily turned on anyone else participating in a protest where, you know, a window gets broken. That's the sort of thing that happens in protests all the time. And, you know, I think there is a we can be appropriately and justly outraged at what happened on the 6th, but also want to be prudent in the way we react in a way that does not chill legitimate protest, does not say if anyone commits a crime, everyone in, you know, within a 100-foot radius is implicated in that.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Patrick Eddington is a research fellow at Cato. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.